Welcome to this week's Military History Program. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Ken Wilson, reading today from HistoryNet.com. Our first article is entitled, A Wrinkle in Time on the Grounds of an Infamous Civil War General's Plantation. Navigating Three Centuries of Disproportionate Mystique at Gideon Pillow's Clifton Place in Tennessee. By John Banks, from HistoryNet.com for February 20, 2024. On a cloudless, deep blue sky afternoon, I drive 45 miles south of Nashville to Columbia for a visit with one of my favorite people, Campbell Ridley. He's an 80-year-old, semi-retired farmer, U.S. Army veteran, rock and roll devotee, and storyteller with a wit and sense of humor as sharp as the tip of a new bayonet. How are you feeling? I asked my friend minutes after arriving at his farm office. Aside from mourning the recent death of Barney, his 9-year-old barn cat, Ridley feels fine, a fact he attributes to clean living and cheap beer. He wears tan Carhartts, brown work boots, a blue checkered shirt, and appropriately a baseball cap with the words, Life is good, across the front. Ridley's roots run deep here in Maury County, one of the wealthiest counties in the state before the Civil War. He's the great-great-grandnephew of Gideon Pillow, the Confederate Brigadier General, Mexican War veteran, politician, lawyer, and, before the war, one of the foremost slaveholders in the county. Ridley's paternal great-grandfather, who depended on mules for farming and was one of the county's leading citizens, earned the nickname Mule King. Columbia, in fact, has long been touted as the mule capital of the world. When I need my history fix and a good laugh, I visit Ridley. We've sat together inside magnificent St. John's Church, a slave-constructed plantation church built under the direction of Leonidas Polk and his brothers. It stands roughly a mile and a half southwest along Mount Pleasant Pike, across the road from the mostly empty field where Polk, an Episcopalian bishop and future Confederate lieutenant general, lived in a mansion called Ashwood Hall. There we have admired the two massive ginkgo trees Polk imported eons ago from Japan, and have poked about what little remains of brick kitchen for the mansion, destroyed by fire in 1874 and never rebuilt. Today, though, we will explore far more humble construction. Near Ridley's farm office and the East Fork of Greenlit Creek stand three ramshackle slave cabins. The Quarters, Ridley calls the property, which is owned by his daughter, who lives in New Mexico, and a friend. I'll take care of this until she puts me in a nursing home, he says half-jokingly. In a way, these cabins are as much a part of Ridley as the land he has farmed for decades in Columbia. As late as the 1990s, he tells me, these humble structures served as homes for poor black farmhands and others. Many of them worked for the Ridleys. The woman who raised me lived here, Ridley says as we examine one of the rickety cabins. Her name was Kate, a wonderful lady who had a gift for cooking fried chicken. The Ridley family employed her for more than three decades. At another cabin yards away, ancient white paint clings to exposed exterior logs. Four modern wooden posts strain to prop up its porch overhang above two large, well-worn walkway stones. On an exterior wall, a half-dozen old hangers dangle from a rusty nail. Above us, a corrugated tin roof keeps nature at bay.
That's been there as long as I can remember, Ridley says.
What a contrast these antebellum structures make with Clifton Place, the brick manor house on the hill 750 yards away. In rich late fall sunlight, the mansion almost seems to glow.
Peek through trees from the road leading to Ridley's farm office, and you'll spot its imposing Ionic columns and impressive limestone porch. From 1839 until the early years of the war, when the U.S. Army confiscated the property, the mansion served as a centerpiece of Clifton Place, Pillow's plantation that encompassed hundreds of acres. His slaves, most of whom lived in cabins at the quarters, generated his wealth by planting and harvesting cotton, hemp, corn, and other crops, as well as tending to his cattle, sheep, and hogs. As one of Tennessee's leading citizens and one of the wealthiest men in the South, Pillow moved in elite social circles. He counted James K. Polk, the 11th U.S. president, among his friends. Following the end of his presidency in 1849, Polk dined at Clifton Palace with Gideon and his wife Mary. Pillow himself dabbled in national politics, opposing secession initially in 1861 before relenting. As a military man, though, political General Pillow failed to measure up. During the Mexican War, the twice-wounded Pillow angered superiors, including Winfield Scott, for his self-promotion. No surprise, perhaps, given a massive painting of a heroic Pillow in military uniform greeted visitors in the front entrance of Clifton Place. During the Civil War, Pillow abandoned his post at Fort Donelson in February 1862, sneaking away from the beleaguered garrison under the cover of darkness before the Union Army under Ulysses S. Grant accepted the Confederate surrender. At the Battle of Stones River, nearly 10 months later, Pillow led a brigade with mixed results. True or not, a story of the 55-year-old officer cowering behind a tree during the battle has stained his resume ever since. Unsurprisingly, Scott, overall commander of the U.S. Army when the Civil War broke out, did not count himself among Pillow's fans. In his 1864 memoirs, Old Fuss and Feathers described Pillow as amiable and possessed of some acuteness, but the only person I have ever known who was wholly indifferent in the choice between truth and falsehood, honesty and dishonesty, ever as ready to attain an end by the one as the other, and habitually boastful of acts of cleverness at the total sacrifice of moral character. As we walk from cabin to cabin, Ridley reflects only briefly on his connection to Pillow and the slaves who toiled for him. "Just part of history," he says. Ridley and I gingerly step into a cabin, home for Pillow's field slaves. More than a year ago, he had rush and other vegetation cleared from around these remarkable survivors, giving us easy access. Each cabin is roughly 15 by 15 feet, with a small loft accessed by a rickety ladder. Each has a post-Civil War room out back. I visited the site a half dozen times, but see something new each time. Steps ahead of me, Ridley shines the narrow beam from his flashlight on a fireplace, revealing bricks and small dirt piles in an otherwise barren room. Fragments of newspaper, used as insulation by post-war inhabitants, speckle the walls. A dour-looking baseball player stares from a March 1937 newspaper sports section. A decrepit floor, victimized by time and nature, crunches beneath my feet. In another cabin, we find more reminders of the 20th century. A swinging blade, peeling wallpaper adorned with blue and aqua-colored floral designs, a chipped axe handle, and a barren clothes hook on a door. Pasted to the back wall is a fragment of the New York Times from decades ago. "Life in America," the partial headline reads. From the era of slavery, though, we find no visible evidence they were here. No fragments of 19th century pottery or shards of glass. No messages etched on bare wooden walls. No privy to mine for secrets. Much is left for our imaginations. And so I wonder, who were these men, women, and children? What treatment did they receive from Pillow?
What were their names? Perhaps the 1870 U.S. Census provides us hints. Sarah and Randall, listed as farmhands for the Pillow family in that census, appear on deeds as far back as the 1840s. I wonder what ultimately became of the slaves who toiled for Pillow. Were they buried in the nearby cemetery in the woods, the remote graveyard at the base of Ginger Hill that Ridley showed me months ago? Or were they buried in St. John's Church Cemetery, far in the back, away from the final resting places for the white folks? Or perhaps they ended up in one of the scores of family cemeteries that dot the county. And I wonder what will become of these historic treasures near the East Fork of Greenlick Creek. Ridley wants to save the cabins, but that probably would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and more expertise than he has. What would a professional archaeologist unearth here? I also wonder what will happen to Clifton Place, where Ridley's paternal grandfather lived until 1949. It remained part of the Ridley family for years afterward.
"I watched television in there for the first time in my life," Ridley says.
He recalls family gatherings in the 12-room Greek Revival-style mansion and 16-foot-high ceilings. In 1972, a Kentucky Fried Chicken magnate named John R. Neal purchased the property from the Ridley family. He and his wife Linda aimed to restore the mansion, but their years-long effort proved daunting.
"We saw the white columns, the gone-with-the-wind atmosphere," she told the reporter in 1986. "We didn't see the cracks, the structural problems."
The Clifton Place grounds include the original detached kitchen, carriage house, ice house, law office, spring house, blacksmith, and quarters for house slaves. In the Pillow era, smokehouse stands, the original popular chopping block, and ham logs, hollowed-out poplar logs for the salting of hams. The smoky aroma in the small brick building still tantalizes.
"The most complete 19th-century plantation complex anywhere,"
a researcher once called Clifton Place. John Neal died in 2018, but Clifton Place remains with his family. The mansion, however, has stood unoccupied and inaccessible to the public for more than a decade. Like the nearby slave cabins, it too could become nothing but a memory without significant preservation efforts. Time may not be on the side of people like us who relish places like this. In an empty field across Mount Pleasant Pike from Clifton Place, developers have plans for residential housing.
750 houses on 450 acres, Ridley says.
Oh my, what will I see here a decade from now? And that ends the article entitled A Wrinkle in Time on the Grounds of an Infamous Civil War General's Plantation, by John Banks from HistoryNet.com for February 20th, 2024. John Banks is author of 3 Civil War books. Check out his latest, A Civil War Road Trip of a Lifetime, from Gettysburg Publishing. He also can be visited on Facebook at John Banks Civil War Blog. This article originally appeared in the Spring 2024 issue of Civil War Times. Our next article is entitled, These Hoosier Heroes at Gettysburg Were Among the Last Men Standing in the Civil War. Brigadier General Joseph K.F. Mansfield remarked that the 20th Indiana
could do longer without food, eat more when they got it, and could suffer more without being disabled.
By Charles J. Rebesco from HistoryNet.com for February 19, 2024. Writing home in the early morning hours of July 2, 1863, it likely crossed John Wheeler's mind that this might be the last letter he would ever write. Wary of the impending combat he and his men were about to face on Gettysburg's second day, the 20th Indiana Infantry's colonel could be forgiven for such somber reflection. 2 years earlier, as war clouds loomed over the fractured nation, Wheeler had been editor and co-founder of his home state's Crown Point Register, proclaiming on its masthead, independent in all things, neutral in nothing. It was a supplication he had also lived by as a soldier and commander. Early in the war, Wheeler, a distant relative of eventual Confederate cavalry general Joseph Wheeler, raised a 100-man company and was elected captain. Among those to enlist were the sons of a family friend, Albert Luther and his brother John, vice president of a local bank. Spearheading the region's prolific recruitment effort was Erasmus Corwin Gilbreth, a lawyer and entrepreneur who before the war had helped bring a railroad to the county seat. For his energy and notoriety, he was named a lieutenant in the 20th Indiana. The 20th's first assignment was guarding railroads in Maryland. He was then sent to the North Carolina coast, and in January 1862 was stationed at Fort Monroe, Virginia, under Brigadier General Joseph King Fenno Mansfield, later mortally wounded at Antietam. On March 8th, the Hoosiers were called to nearby Hampton Roads to help protect the stricken USS Congress from capture by CSS Virginia. Fire from the 20th wounded Virginia's commander, Flag Officer Franklin Buchanan, and helped drive off Confederate boarding parties. The 20th, an impressed Mansfield later remarked, could do without food longer, eat more when they got it, could suffer more without being disabled, get in line quicker, stay there steadier, and swear harder than any group of men. On May 10, 1862, President Lincoln visited Fort Monroe, and while watching his fellow Midwesterners prepare for a move on Norfolk, reportedly cheered, "Bully for the Indiana 20th!" Joining the Army of the Potomac during the Pennsylvania campaign, the 20th was assigned to Major General Phil Kearney's 3rd Division of the 3rd Corps. Kearney raved about the 20th's fighting ability at Oak Grove, Savage's Station, and Glendale during the 7 days battles, labeling them, "My 20th Indiana marksmen." "If I had 40,000 men like those of the 20th Indiana," he declared, "I could fight and whip any army in the world." After fighting at Second Bull Run and then Ox Hill, where Kearney was killed, the 20th was assigned during the subsequent Antietam campaign to the defenses of Washington, D.C., but returned to the Army of the Potomac before the Battle of Fredericksburg. On December 13, 1862, a day described by Captain Gilbreth as being of almost September brightness and warmth, the Hoosiers saved Captain George Randolph's artillery in the 3rd Corps by bringing up ammunition and manning the pieces after the battery lost infantry support. A grateful Randolph remarked after the war that the 20th was the best regiment, volunteer or regular, that I had the fortune to serve with. We were always glad to know they were near. Gilbreth suffered a severe right leg wound during the fighting that day, but bravely spurned amputation, somehow surviving. The wound, however, would require corrective surgery in 1875. Despite having limited use of the leg for 2 years and suffering a permanent limp, he returned to duty in April 1863. Intense fighting at Gettysburg. In the spring of 1863, Wheeler was promoted to colonel and given command. John Luther was made lieutenant, becoming Wheeler's adjutant. During the Chancellorsville campaign, the 20th helped lead the 3rd Corps advance and captured a horde of prisoners of the 23rd Georgia Infantry in Brigadier General Alfred Colquitt's brigade, part of Lieutenant General Stonewall Jackson's 2nd Corps. Later, the Hoosiers were involved in a night action and served in the rear guard for the retreat over the Rappahannock River. Brigadier General John Henry Hobart Ward, their brigade commander, praised the regiment's coolness and undaunted courage, noting it sustained its well-earned reputation gained on the peninsula. Wheeler was proud of how his men performed in one of the most severe battles and confidently wrote home that Western men are the thing. The Army could do much more if we had more men from Maine and the West.
We are all well and ready for anything that comes along.
What came along would prove a severe test. The 20th arrived in Gettysburg after dark on July 1st, spending a tense night sleeping with weapons ready, on the Union left, on the south end of Cemetery Ridge. On July 2nd, the regiment was placed in the Rose Woods on Hawks Ridge with most of Ward's 2nd Brigade. With the launch of Lieutenant General James Longstreet's attack at 4 p.m., the Hoosiers, along with the 86th New York, soon found themselves hotly engaged with the 3rd Arkansas. The Union troops had initial success, driving back the Southerners and advancing as Ward had directed, only to be ordered back a short time later. As he had ominously feared, Wheeler was an early casualty, shot from his horse and falling dead at the distinctive boulder across the road from what is now the 20th Monument. He was quickly buried by the Luther brothers. The firing was rapid and intense. When John rejoined the fight using a discarded rifle, he was hit by a spent bullet and left dazed. Describing the action to his family, Albert wrote,
"We had to fire slower because the gun barrels had got so hot. We could hardly hold them."
Ward's men resisted the Southern attack for more than an hour, but by 5:30 p.m., with Lafayette McLaws Georgians having joined the fight, the Confederates grabbed the upper hand. Gilbreth assumed command of the 20th when Lieutenant Colonel William C.L. Taylor was wounded. Ward, aware his men were low on ammunition, ordered the 20th and his nearby regiments to pull back. Bristling at how the rebels laughed when the Hoosiers' flag fell, Gilbreth took satisfaction in that those colors were immediately recovered and that the struggle had been anything but a rout. The 20th, according to the official records, held the position assigned it until the brigade commenced to retire and fell back in good order. For one account, the 20th moved 300 yards to the rear where it halted and reformed its ranks. Official reports and recollections from the neighboring regiments, as well as the captured missing numbers for Ward's entire brigade, confirmed that Ward was able to bring his men back in good order from Hawks Ridge, contrary to the commonly made assumption that the Third Corps simply folded and ran when attacked. On July 3rd, the 20th was sent to the center of the line for cleanup in the wake of Pickett's charge, and later was placed on burial duty. Gettysburg had been a memorable battle for the Hoosiers. Dudley Chase, an Indiana judge who was wounded at the Rose Woods while serving in the 17th U.S. Regulars, later recalled they were desperately fighting, out of the jaws of death and the gates of hell. The cost was high. Of 401 men engaged, the 20th had 32 killed, 114 wounded, and 10 captured or missing. Those totals represented 25% of Ward's deaths during the battle, and 20% of his total losses. Despite the bloodshed, the mood of some of the men was buoyant. Riding home, one Hoosier reported 14 casualties in his company alone, but threatened the rebels with
wailing and a sound thrashing
if the Southerners did not return to Virginia quickly. Albert Luther boasted to his family that Lee's men got
a sound whipping
and that
we are ready and anxious to give them another battle.
The subsequent arduous pursuit of the Army of Northern Virginia to the Potomac River rendered some of the Hoosiers shoeless, and the pace diminished Albert's fervor. In fact, he felt
so tired at night I could hardly stand.
The anticipated showdown with Lee's defeated army would not occur, as the Confederates were back in Virginia by July 14th. Last left standing. In August 1863, the 20th was one of the Western regiments handed the grueling task of keeping order in New York City after the July draft riots. Although Gilbreth chose to romanticize the famed metropolis,
most of us had only dreamed of the city.
His regiment was unable to let up
for even a moment, at one point meeting with a howling mob, and, fixing bayonets, marched off, driving the crowd before us. As the Overland campaign approached the spring of 1864, John Luther expressed apprehension and optimism. "All are dreading the heavy campaign that is staring us in the face." But he also appraised the Army of the Potomac as being never more formidable. The fighting that May and June left him despondent, however. "After the most hard battle ever fought, I'm still alive, and that is about all." Expressing both resignation and relief, he wrote from Cold Harbor, Virginia, "It seems a miracle that I am here, that it is my luck to be spared so far." In the later reorganization of the Army of the Potomac, the men of the 7th, 14th, and 19th Indiana were consolidated into the 20th, which was renamed the 20th Indiana Veteran Volunteer Infantry. This was another source of pride for the men of the 20th. "No greater compliment could be paid you," Chase opined at their 1888 reunion. The other Indiana regiments, all with memorable service, became members of the 20th. The 20th was the Indiana Infantry Regiment, last left standing in the Army of the Potomac. Active through the Petersburg and Appomattox campaigns, it fired its final guns on April 9, 1865. Back in Indianapolis, the 20th mustered out in July. John Wheeler was buried on July 30, 1863, in Crown Point, with nearly 1,000 mourners in attendance, including both Luther brothers. To this day, the town has not forgotten the colonel, naming a new school in his honor in 2007, with his uniform and murals commemorating the 20th on display. The Luther brothers survived the war, with John living until 1924, and fortunate to attend Gettysburg's 50th anniversary reunion in 1913. Albert was not so blessed, dying before his 30th birthday. The two were buried within feet of Wheeler at Maplewood Cemetery. Gilbreth made a career of the military and died in 1898 while on active duty. He is buried in Arlington National Cemetery alongside his wife and daughter. A family heirloom was a handkerchief stained with Lincoln's blood. His father-in-law was a friend of the slain president. In 1889, at the ceremony inaugurating construction of the Soldiers and Sailors Monument in Indianapolis, the 20th was the only Indiana unit to have its flag placed in the cornerstone. Its soldiers, the last men standing at home as well. And that ends the article entitled, "These Hoosier Heroes at Gettysburg Were Among the Last Men Standing in the Civil War," by Charles J. Rubesco from HistoryNet.com for February 19, 2024. Charles J. Rubesco, a first-time contributor, writes from Munster, Indiana. This article originally appeared in the spring 2024 issue of America's Civil War magazine. And that's all of our time for military history this week. I'm Ken Wilson for the Virginia Voice. You can hear this program every Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m., with a rebroadcast on Sunday night at 11:30. Or listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.